vegetarian food by a group, Unlimited Culture. A bit of sort of Rastafarian stuff going on there. Anyway, tonight we introduce our feature interview series, In Conversation. This is with Alice Zaslavsky. Alice is a food figure about town, known for her infectious enthusiasm and her ability to encourage people of all ages to cook and taste. She has a new book out, In Praise of Veg. It's big, bold, and informative, a bit like Alice herself. As Rita Ehrlich found when they talked about the book, also about Alice's experiences on MasterChef and what she would do if she were National Minister for Food.
I'm talking to Alice Zaslavsky, whose new book, In Praise of Veg, comes out this week. It's her second book, and it's an extraordinary volume. It's big, it's colourful, it's hugely, hugely informative, and it follows on from the fun and deliciousness of her first book, which was Alice's Food, A to Z. Your name fits very nicely into A to Z.
It's a little too convenient, isn't it?
Alice, how did this all come about? How did you get so interested in food, first of all?
Well, I think you will definitely relate to this. When I think about the food writers in Australia and certainly all over the world, I think that Jewish food writers are very overly represented. And it comes back to our culture. It comes back to the way that we think about food and speak about food around the table. We connect around the table over food. So many of our festivals have so many symbolic foods. And so I think it's a very natural place for me to play. And obviously, when I do play in that place, it takes me back to so many fond memories. So that's why I enjoy bringing those fond memories to as many people as possible.
There's also a lot about the excitement of cooking and eating and tasting. And you talk about your first taste of banana and kiwi fruit when you were living in Tbilisi and your brother went to Switzerland and came home with a banana and a kiwi fruit.
Yes, that was definitely one of my fondest, earliest memories of food. And it's no accident that it's of foods that were unusual to me, because I think that that's kind of been a driving factor for me continuing to discover new things, because food is such a, there's so much more to learn, even having been in it for as long as I have and even for as long as you have, Rita. I'm sure that there are still new things that you discover every day, and it's exciting.
Oh, it is exciting, and that's the lovely thing about it, that we keep learning, we keep tasting, we keep discovering. You were a teacher, and for me it shows, because both books are really about teaching people about the excitement of food, how to cook, and how not to be afraid of food.
Yes, and I think the best teachers are also still willing to learn. There are different ways to teach. Certainly, you know, you can be instructional, you can be informative, you can be didactic, you can be a rule enforcer. But for me, when I was in the classroom, I was always learning with my students and encouraging them to be excited about what it was that we were learning. So you're right. I think that definitely still comes through in my writing and in my, you know, all of my broadcasting as well.
It's said, I've heard musicians say it all the time, the best way to learn is to teach.
Yes, definitely. It's so true. So true. Yeah. And the best lessons I've learned have been when I've been on stage with chefs from around the world, and when they teach the audience new tricks, I put those tricks under my hat for later.
Good. Now, I'll just tell everyone about In Praise of Veg, which is colour-coded, and that in itself is pretty interesting, because it's a way of getting people to look at food differently. Yes. And about 20 years ago, I wrote a book with another Alice, Alice Merkies, who's a doctor, and we called it Colour Me Healthy, because what we learnt was that the colour of food was an indicator of its nutrient value.
Yes.
So
yes.
If you eat rainbows, you're going to get a good diet, basically. Your recipes are full of tips, hints, what goes with what, how to use leftovers, all of that. So it's an enormously practical book, as well as a really comprehensive book. When did you, you haven't given up teaching, but when did you give up classrooms?
Well, I had to give up classrooms when I went on MasterChef. I didn't think I'd have to. When I auditioned for the show, I thought that I could just come, you know, step right back into the classroom. But a week into the audition process, I was told that if I didn't turn up to work the next day, then I didn't have a job. So it really was a real leap of faith and a real kind of, you know, what's behind door number two, path less travelled. And I'm sure as heck glad that I took that path and open that door, because I feel like I'm still teaching and I do feel like my classroom's just gotten bigger. Obviously, I do miss it. I miss the camaraderie of the staff room. I miss the light bulb moments that you see across the room when your students learn something new. But I feel like I get enough of that now through my work with Phenomenom and through even the emails that I get from people that cook my recipes or ask me questions about food.
Yeah, and they're lovely. Those interactions are lovely. Tell us about Phenomenom.
Well, Phenomenom is a digital toolkit, so it's a bunch of videos, podcast episodes and lesson plans for teachers as well as for parents, because if there's one thing that 2020 has taught us, it's that we can learn from anywhere and learning can happen anytime. And it's designed to encourage kids to think about food differently and also encourage grown-ups to talk to kids about food differently, because one of the things that we naturally do is start to talk to them about how good vegetables are for them and how they're healthy, but none of that works in encouraging kids to try new things. We're much better off starting from a place of curiosity, and that will spark the encouragement to try something new.
I think that's true. And I also think we have to respect, particularly with kids, we have to respect the fact that for some of them, the smell of certain foods or the texture of certain foods is very, very strange indeed.
Yes,
and
we
have to be patient about that.
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of that is in us not being so attached to them trying everything and liking everything. You know, people say to me even, you know, oh, Hazel's such a good eater, she eats everything. And I say, nope, she doesn't. You know, there are some things that I've put down in front of her and she's tasted them and gone, not for me. And then I've tasted it and gone, not for me either. Like, what a fine palate you have.
Yeah, that's right. How did MasterChef affect your life, your career, and what happened afterwards?
Well, I think for anyone that's been on a reality TV program, it's a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, it you know, flips your life upside down. It gives you opportunities that you never expected. And on the other hand, I think there's a bit of a stigma that comes with choosing to go on a program like that, because people think, you know, are they really serious about this? You know, why didn't they go off and do an apprenticeship, let's say, if you're going on a program like MasterChef? Why don't you just go into the kitchen and be a chef? But for me, MasterChef really was almost like another university course. It was an opportunity to learn as much as I could in an environment where everybody was on the same page as me and where we were meeting people that we would otherwise not meet. You know, I got to cook against Jamie Oliver, and I got to cook for Rick Stein and Massimo Bottura, and, you know, meet all these amazing chefs that I'd only read about in books. And so even the relationships that I formed with the judges, you know, I'm still very much in contact with Matt and Gary and George, and I'm still in contact with some of the contestants as well. So it's almost like having another network or another family, I suppose, that you can call on. So on the balance of it, I would say that the MasterChef experience was one that was positive and enriching to my life, but it certainly was not without its stresses, Rita.
What were the stresses? The hours and having to eat?
Well, I think what people don't realise is that in order to go on the show, there's a little bit of a Big Brother element. You are in lockdown with the people that you're competing against. So normally we're in a very comfortable environment with our family and our friends and people that think like us, whereas MasterChef is very much you're all fish out of water and you're all trying to support each other whilst also competing against each other. So you can understand why people seem a little bit on edge when they're in their interviews.
Yeah. But, Absolutely, yeah.
But I think going through that, it kind of also cements for you, are you really serious about this? Do you really want to do this? What sacrifices are you willing to make? And that baptism of fire has meant that, you know, I can think up a recipe at the drop of a hat. I can stay up for 17, 18 hours. And, you know, at the moment with a toddler.
That's what you're doing.
Exactly. That's right. So, I think every experience in our lives helps us along the journey, whatever it is. We just might not see it at the time. So I'm really grateful for it. And people ask me, you know, should I go on the show? And I say, what do you want to get out of it?
Yeah. And how serious are you about it? Exactly. I think that's a really important aspect of it, that 100%. You have to be deeply committed to it.
Exactly.
As the guys were.
Yes.
Now, I'm going to, you're a food educator, you're a writer, you're all sorts of things. I'm going to make you Australia's first Minister of Food. Now, we may or may not get these things through Parliament, but I'm going to ask you, as Australia's first Minister for Food, what are going to be the first three things you do? What's the first bit of legislature you want to get through?
Well, I would subsidise fresh food and make it more accessible to people. I would create opportunities for upskilling, because it's one thing to kind of tell people to eat more fresh produce, but it's another to expect them to know what to do with it. So if it's already been subsidised, so it's more affordable and there are more access points beyond just, you know, the usual places. And we've learned that actually in 2020, we can get things to people's doorsteps pretty simply. So that might be something to think about. And the third would be... I think that there's a lot of support that can be given to small producers, and we're seeing it now in helping them to tell their stories and convey what it is that makes them special. And I think that Australian producers in particular, we have got so many different exciting stories to tell, and you know that better than anyone. And I feel like we have a real opportunity, you know, considering how small our country is, we have a real opportunity to also get that produce out globally and in that way stimulate our local economy too. So they would be my three things, and perhaps we could use some of that extra, you know, revenue from all these small producers killing it overseas to subsidise the fresh produce more locally. How does that sound?
I think that sounds great. I love the idea of subsidising fresh produce because for me, one of the issues has always been accessibility of food.
Big time.
Both geographically accessible and financially accessible.
Totally.
And can I add a couple of things to your ministry? I'd like everyone to have a wok and a couple of saucepans.
What a great idea. Pop that on the doorstep along with the fresh food. I love that.
Yeah, that's right. And I'd also make sure that from kindergarten onwards, kids learnt about handling food. I've heard some really alarming stories about 20-year-olds fronting up to food vans, not food vans selling food, but food education vans, holding an egg saying, so what do I do with this?
Yeah, and that's something, you know, I think you'll notice, especially for someone who's a food educator, you would have expected that I say education. But one thing that has occurred is that there are so many different players in the space and so many kind of different vested interests that education and food education has been co-opted at times. So I think that as food minister, I would quality control, and I would actually delegate that to some people that are very much, I'd have an academic that's looking at the current research into how we teach kids about food, because there are better ways than necessarily just kind of, you know, slapping them with perfect plate and food pyramid worksheets.
Yep.
and I would look at models overseas. So, for example, you know, the Kitchen Garden Foundation model is fantastic. What else can we learn from the Edible Schoolyard from Alice Waters? What else can we learn from Taste Ed over in the UK? Japan have some incredible food education programs. So what can we borrow, like a magpie? What can we borrow from different cultures and countries to enrich our food education space in really meaningful and purposeful ways?
I think those are all great ideas. I'm a great believer in learning by doing.
Oh yes, yeah.
So for me, you get people involved really early on. Years ago, there was a book put out by the Creche Association in Paris. It had all sorts of recipes in it. It had a full list of recipes, which were fabulous meal plans, and some of the best advice I've ever come across. It's all got too complicated now, but one of their bits of advice was get kids involved in the preparation of food. And we're talking about three-year-olds here.
Yes, and well, even Hazel, I'm already getting her into the kitchen, and she's already doing things like I might half peel an onion and kind of leave the rest for her to do, or she might spin the salad spinner. She loves it because she can tell I love it too.
Yeah, that's right. So what you're doing is sharing the joy.
Yes.
And you're particularly sharing the joy in Praise of Veg. The tone of that book I adore because it's full of excitement and enthusiasm and really useful bits of information. So it's all the ways of learning that we've talked about. It's on the shelves from this week, I think, and this week bookshops are open, which is wonderful.
Rita, I'm just letting those words wash over me. You are just so kind and generous and obviously someone that I very much admire. So to hear that from you about my little book is a big deal. So thank you.
Little book, nonsense. It's a very big book and a wonderful book, and we wish it a lot of success on its journey. Alice Zaslavsky, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Rita. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Rita Ehrlich in conversation with Alice Zaslavsky. This is the Travel Writer Show on J Air 88 FM in Melbourne.